Commerce to order. It's March 10th, and it's 1:38. Excuse me. And on the agenda for today, with us today, Senator Seekin, Senator Ellis, and myself, Bundy, Stevens, and Davis are excused. On today's schedule, HB 15, liquor license for lodges and bars, HB 90, state warranties, treasury warrants. Those are both previously heard bills and ready for action. And we will continue our work on SB 130, workers' comp. So with that, Mr. Pawlowski, we have here for Representative Meyer. Do you have any additional comments you wanted to make on HB 15?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Michael Pawlowski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer. The only comment I would make is that Representative Meyer asked me to apologize that he could not be here himself today. And with that, I'd be available to answer any of your questions that I may.
All right, and we do have Doug Griffith on the line if we have questions. Is there further testimony on HB 15 here in Juneau? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. Do we have any amendments? Seeing none, the will of the committee? Senator Seekin.
Chairman, I'd move that we advance CS for House Bill Number 15, Labor and Commerce, as amended from committee with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal notes.
Okay.
Senator Ellis?
Yes.
Senator
Seekin? Yes. So HB 15 is on its way, and we will then turn to HB 90, which is the state treasury warrants, and Representative Seekin is with us today. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For the record?
For the record, my name is Paul Seekin. I'm the chair of House State Affairs.
Do you have additional comments you'd like to make on HB 90?
I think that you've had all the information. I would let you know that we do have Kim Gennaro from Division of Finance and Michelle Prebola from the Revenue Division if you have any technical questions.
Do you have questions for Representative Seekin? Seeing none, is there anyone here who would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. If we have no amendments, will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I...
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to move the table, but...
I'm going to help you out here. Mr. Chairman, I move that House Bill 90 be referred on to the next committee with individual recommendations and any accompanying fiscal notes.
Jane?
Senator Seekin?
Yes.
Senator Ellis?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. So indeed.
Thank you very much.
House bills are on their way.
Senator Bundy. They want to sign this as chairman.
Oh,
that's probably
a good idea.
My lungs and my brain going all at the same time.
Yeah. You're just about over it, aren't you?
The cough is much better, but not as good as I'd like to be. Okay, there you go. All right, that brings us to our bill that gets heavier every day. Senate Bill 130, workers' comp, and Mr. Lozanki has joined us for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Paul F. Lozanki. I am the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And I have been asked to continue our presentation of the bill to the committee and pick up where Commissioner O'Clary left off with his overview from the other day.
Hey, that would be fine. Oh, there's my pencil. The world stops until I find my pencil. Okay.
What I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, is work through some of the major sections of the bill, not necessarily in numerical order, but in kind of substantive order, and I can cross-reference them to sectional sites so that you can read along if you wish, or I know that there were some questions about some of the sections that we briefly discussed in the first hearing.
Yeah, so if you do the referencing, please, and then we can follow.
Sure. The first area that the actually there are a number of major areas that are addressed by this bill, and the motivations are as explained to you by Commissioner O'Clary. The first section I'd like to address to the committee is one that I've put under the heading of protecting workers' benefits and their jobs from uninsured employers. Now, this is a subject that will sound familiar to the members of the committee because we did discuss it somewhat last session. We continue to be concerned about the employers who don't follow the letter of the law and continue to operate notwithstanding their failure to ensure their liabilities for workers' compensation benefits. And, of course, we worry about that because it jeopardizes the economic and physical health of the injured worker, and it also jeopardizes the economic health of the law-abiding employers who are trying to do business with this substantially increasing overhead cost. And if they're undercut by people who are breaking the law, then it hurts them directly as well. So in Section 21 of this bill, there is a proposal to allow the division director to immediately shut down an employer upon completion of an investigation confirming that there is a lack of the required insurance. This is something that we think is important because you might have heard me testify last session. One of the problems we've run up against is it's difficult to detect uninsured employers to begin with. It takes a lot of effort. All too often when our investigator finds one, under the current law, all we can really do is bring them before the Workers' Compensation Board for a hearing and attempt to shut them down with a stop work order. And while that usually works fine, if they continue to abuse their right to work under the law, what all too often what happens is they run out and they get insurance after they're caught, sometimes up to and including almost a day of the hearing. And so then we don't have any tool in our arsenal to assert against them, and they may have been operating, risking their employers and unfairly competing for a significant period of time, although we do try to have the hearings as quickly as we can. So this first provision would require us to get an investigator on site, complete an investigation. If they are convinced that there's reason to believe that there is no insurance, then they'll be able to call me, and we can have a very quick kind of telephonic hearing, if you will. And if I conclude that their investigation is correct, if this person doesn't have insurance, we'll close them down that day.
Let me ask about that investigation. You said on site. It seems as wouldn't it be pretty straightforward to electronically check with the, we've only got two insurance companies to see if they are indeed covered?
It's relatively Mr. Chairman, it's relatively straightforward, but there are, even with the electronic system that we recently installed, there are gaps between for some legitimate reasons, when coverage is bound and when it actually shows up in our system. So we certainly try and do that first. And there is, as you know, in the law, a presumption that not having the proof of coverage on file raises a rebuttable presumption of failure to cover. But we do occasionally run into situations where when we get the person's input, they point out to us, or their insurance broker points out to us, that they believe that they are within the law, and then we track it back, and it turns out that, yes, indeed, it's paperwork.
Senator Seekins.
Well, without having looked at this statute, what is the evidence of compliance that's required by 2330.085?
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, the evidence of compliance used to be a piece of paper that indicated that you were insured. Now it's an electronic document that's filed by your insurer that's sent to us and gets entered into our computer system that indicates that your company is properly covered for a period of time for workers' compensation liability in the state of Alaska by X company.
So if I could, Mr. Chairman, then you could foresee here glitch somewhere in the electronic system shutting a person down, and the burden of proof is on them, or is there any? Are you proposing any other process to be able to show that they do have insurance?
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, the process is designed so that they would have an opportunity to be heard, because we are reluctant to just take that rebuttable presumption and shut somebody down based upon it. So, to answer your question directly, that's why we anticipate that we would have a follow-up investigation, get in contact with the people who are under suspicion, give them an opportunity to give us any proof that they have, to direct us to an insurance agent that they believe that they talked to, or the business manager, or anything. We're not looking to jeopardize people's rights to make a living on something that could be just a paperwork glitch.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, the bill that we passed last year on workers' comp that said that a subcontractor, if they don't have insurance, that the contractor is required to carry that coverage, or if the contractor doesn't, the project owner would be required to carry that coverage. How would you anticipate looking at a subcontractor violation then? Would you go right on upstream and ask for coverage from the other people?
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, I don't think that we've actually done that yet, but since you asked me to envision it, I think that we would, it would just be prudent to check up and to see that the next level did have the insurance that your bill that passed last year does require. But I think we would be inclined to still go after the subcontractor. Last year's bill is meant to be a safety net. I don't think it's meant to be a substitute for people doing their legally required
business. Oh, I understand that too, but I guess I'm wondering in that scenario, if I said, well, you know, under the law, if I don't carry it, the contractor is required to carry it, and that's my substantial proof of coverage.
Through the chair, I guess I would construe it a little differently. I would consider that would not prove that the subcontractor had the required coverage. It would prove that their employees are not in extreme danger of not having their benefits paid. I would agree with that. So I could see that being offered as a reason we'd probably talk to the contractor and see if they wanted to keep working, and we'd probably take that into account. I guess I certainly would.
I'm not trying to propose a loophole. I'm just trying to see if one exists somewhere.
Right.
Please continue.
And just to finish this relatively short provision, there is also a provision in Section 21 that addresses the lack of a hammer that I mentioned. And the hammer now is actually a bigger hammer than we talked about last session. For a proven failure to insure, we can go to the Workers' Compensation Board with a full hearing, because we don't feel that there's this, you know, once we've taken care of the absence of insurance quickly, we don't think it's as important to move quickly on the fine part. So we'd like to have that continue to go through the board. And for a demonstrated failure to have the required insurance, an employer would be subject to a fine up to $1,000 a day per employee that was not covered. And you can do the math. That could be a very substantial sum. It is an up-to amount, and it would be, you know, in the province of the board to take into consideration things that were mitigating factors or things that were aggravating factors. But it could be a very high penalty. Last numbers that I've seen, our single investigator, even with some of the problems you've heard about with our computer system, was able to detect and stop 158 employers that were uninsured, and then at least went and got insurance after they were caught. And those employers had approximately 2,300 workers. So if we had a fine in place like we're talking about here, that would be a lot of potential liability to be assessed to convince them that they should never do that again. There's also a section in the bill that I'll address in a moment that actually establishes a fund to receive those fines and uses those fines to pay for the benefits of injured workers who were working for an uninsured employer at the time they were injured and weren't able to get their benefits directly from that employer.
Of that 158 employers last year that gone bare, were there penalties that were imposed, or were these that cured by simply going and getting insurance, and so they...
The vast majority of them were.
They got to go bare and keep that money until they got caught.
Correct. There are some states that that address the problem by saying that the fine will be assessed in light of what their premium would have been. And then the fine is some multiple of their basic premium. But this is a little more broad application.
To clarify this, employer X has been working for a month. He's got 10 people employed, and you find they don't have insurance. He would be liable for up to $1,000 a day for that 30 days times the
times
10 employees.
Each employee, yeah.
Might be a disincentive.
I would think it would be a considerable disincentive from any business that I'm aware of. That I'd like to talk about is one that I've kind of characterized as quicker and more efficient resolution of disputed benefit claims. You heard the commissioner talk about some of our problems in that regard, and Senator Seekins, you raised some questions from people that you've heard about stipulations and the process. One of the areas that will actually make legal something that's happening right now under our regulations, but some people think that the regulation may not be sufficient. Attorney's fees in workers' compensation, even though that they are usually paid by an insurer when in addition to benefits, they're not taken out of the benefits, they have to be approved by the Workers' Compensation Board before they can be legally received, and it's actually a criminal offense to do otherwise. We have a regulation that was based on some concerns that were expressed over the years that there was a need to have a way to get an attorney to give you a consultation, even if they didn't take on your case, just give you some advice, even if the advice was, I can't take your case or I don't think you have such a good case. And so we have a regulation that allows a one-time consultation fee of up to $300 to be paid by the injured worker and received by the attorney. There are some attorneys that thank us for the regulation, but look at the statute and say they don't want to put themselves in that kind of jeopardy, a potential criminal act. So in Section 42 of the bill, it would specifically legalize the receipt of a one-time consultation fee of up to $300. And the hope is that it will make it just a little bit easier for people to at least get an initial consultation and some guidance, even if they continue to have problems getting someone that will actually take on their full case. Another significant change is that Section 9 will provide that the Department of Labor and Workforce Development may contract with a nonprofit organization or organizations to provide some information and legal assistance to injured workers who are unable to obtain private counsel. One of the things we continue to hear is that there's a limited number of private counsel that are willing and able to represent people in workers' compensation matters. We've heard this for a considerable period of time, long before I ever came to the division. People have been talking about it in the 20 years that I've worked in the field. This is kind of an this is kind of an approach that would be an attempt to get a nonprofit organization that has some understanding of, say, disability law, that, but perhaps hasn't focused on workers' compensation at this point, to get them into a contractual relationship with the department for a period of time and see if we can kind of prime them to get in this area of assistance. And then they would be eligible to get attorney fee awards if they were successful in helping people before the board the same way that a private attorney could. And that hopefully then the attorney's fees would take the place of further funding as it went forward. This is, I know, kind of a stretch beyond what we've done over the many years of workers' compensation. We've always left it to the private sector to represent people, but we've continued to hear that a significant number, percentage of people feel and come and testify at a committee such as this that they're unable to get an attorney that's willing to take on their case. And while we give them, the division gives them as much advice and assistance as we can, obviously we can't represent them. And so this is an attempt to kind of encroach on that divide to try and narrow the problems that they have as far as not being able to get help with what their claims should be understood by an attorney.
And these organizations would then provide legal representation?
That is the hope, yes.
Obviously, they would be legally able to provide that. I mean, they'd be members of the bar.
Right, and Mr. Chairman, yeah, the contract would have to delineate the requirements, and that would certainly be one of them. If they're going to represent somebody, they're going to have to be admitted to the bar.
I'm just spoiling that a little bit. If they can't find an attorney, but if there's a nonprofit group that perhaps is able to employ an attorney on a broader scope, then you're hoping you could bring them in. Okay. Senator Thiekin.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sankey, let me go back for a minute to Section 42, if I can.
Yes, sir.
And ask a question here. This one-time fee of $300, is that one-time per insured or one-time per attorney? Because if I'm going attorney shopping, can I go and $300 tend to places?
Through the chair, Senator Thiekin, I believe it would be one-time per attorney. I mean, it's your money. As the injured worker, it would be coming out of your pocket. If you had enough money to pursue a number of consultations, my interpretation of this is yes, you could do that, and the attorney would not have to keep track of whether someone has already utilized this safety valve.
So each attorney could do it, at least take $300 from the insured?
From
any attorney that they choose to talk to, one time.
Through the chair, Senator Thiekin, any injured worker could go to any attorney, and if the attorney wanted to charge a consultation fee up to $300, they could do so.
Is there any mechanism for the insured to recover that $300?
Through the chair, Senator Thiekin, if it develops into a disputed claim and there is some success, I would say yes, an employee, even an injured worker, even if they did it on their own, ultimately, that they could seek recovery of that as a cost of their claim. And I would anticipate that the board would recognize that as a cost of pursuing their claim and reimburse them for it, or order reimbursement for it. Obviously, the board doesn't actually pay anything. There's also section 11, which I put an asterisk next to because I think it goes to part of the question that Senator Thiekin asked the other day about his concerns about the ability of injured workers and their employers and insurers to decide that they no longer want to dispute something and stipulate their way out of it. What section 11 talks about is that it would allow an injured worker who is represented by an attorney who's licensed in Alaska to settle their claims, and that would be either a partial or a complete settlement of a disputed claim without review by the Workers' Compensation Board. That would do two things. One, it would marginally speed up the process in that there is a certain degree of delay associated with having people who have already resolved their disputes have to wait until the Workers' Compensation Board can actually review the terms of their proposed resolution. It would also allow us to focus the resources that we have in the division to either do additional hearings to get other disputes heard quicker and or to review, focus their continuing review responsibility on proposed settlements from injured workers who have some additional need for the board to review their situation, such as they're a minor, or they're mentally incompetent, or if they're unrepresented by counsel. So it would be an opportunity for the board to focus on folks that don't have an attorney by freeing up the folks that do have an attorney to resolve their disputes without further review by the board. We think that that's also going some degree towards addressing the concerns that were expressed by Senator Seekins, because if you can settle a full claim, you can certainly file a what would otherwise be called a, you know, might be referred to as a partial settlement, but a stipulation of somebody's entitlement to something. You could agree to it, you could file it with the board, and it would not have to be further reviewed. That would apply across the spectrum of any dispute. It wouldn't be limited to the one section that I specifically mentioned to the committee last time, which was a specific section that allows stipulation to entitlement to reemployment benefits. That is something that's been developed due to specific complaints that we've received from parties saying that if they want to stipulate that an injured worker needs reemployment benefits, why do we not accept that stipulation and just get on with the process? And our response in this bill is why indeed. And so we do have a specific section that talks about reemployment benefits, and that's in Section 14. But this Section 11 would also apply to arguably to any other type of stipulation or dispute.
Senator Seekin.
I guess I'd have a hard time reading into the fact in this Section 11 that it says that if you and I want to stipulate to the extent of my injury or to the type of the injury, rather than going through the medical examination process and confirmation of that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that we're allowed to do that. I'm just thinking of certain steps in the process where you may not want to stipulate to complete dismissal, but to elements of the process. It's my understanding, and maybe I'm wrong, that right now at least it's viewed as that's a prohibited activity. Maybe I'm wrong.
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, if I understand your question correctly, I don't think you're wrong. The division and the board takes the view that anything that can be read as a partial settlement of any dispute does have to be reviewed, and many things can be viewed as a partial settlement that the parties might look at as just a stipulation of status. If it can be viewed as affecting somebody's right to benefit, and arguably anything can, the current language is so broad that I think the board is within its rights to look at it the way they do under the current law, even though it slows things down.
I have no doubt that's within their rights, if I can, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering if there comes a point where we're trying to do two things, and one of them is reach a final determination as quickly as possible to keep, uncertainty in the process even from developing. And I'm just thinking that there may be intermediate steps in the process that we go to a lot of trouble to verify, even though both parties should have the right, as they do in any other kind of legal activity, to stipulate to certain portions of that activity. But it seems like it's precluded here. And that seems like it protracts the time frame, and maybe even unnecessarily. I don't know if it should be subject to some kind of review, but even most stipulations are at least reviewed even in a court of law to a certain degree. Did you agree to that, Mr. Stang? Did you agree to that, Mr. Seekins? Yes, we both did. And did you do it willingly? No. Yes, no problem. Okay, fine. We stipulate to it. But it seems to me that if the process is inherently clumsy and unnecessarily clumsy, that we should try to accommodate a streamlining of it as long as we aren't sacrificing anyone's rights against their will. But maybe I'm shooting in the dark. That's just my opinion, Mr. Chair.
All right.
And the final point I'd like to make under this heading is that while it's common practice already, the division uses workers' compensation hearing officers to chair hearings of disputed claims. But we don't actually have that in the statute. It simply says the commissioner of the department or their representative. And so just to kind of adjust for what is actually being done and to give us authority to do it in case anybody ever complains about it. Section 7 does require the use of hearing officers. And it's anticipated, I think, everyone knows that since passage of some legislation last session having to do with the central panel hearing process, that all hearing officers will be required to adhere to certain ethical standards that are being reviewed and produced, I guess, as we speak, by the administrative law judge. And this would add to the board an obligation to develop its own internal regulation for any conflict of interest of the lay board members, and that would be something that would be developed internally by the department and approved by the board members themselves as required by the current statute. Moving along, a third heading that I've generated is fair benefits at reasonable employer cost. The first is Section 32, and this will sound kind of reminiscent to people who have been following this process for the last year, since last session anyway. It's a reprise of the cap on non-resident compensation rates. And currently right now there's a cost of living adjustment in the Workers' Compensation Act, and it only applies outside the state. So people who are injured within the state of Alaska get a unified rate, and it's based on a blended assessment of the cost of living in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. Juneau, of course, being the highest, and I think Anchorage and Fairbanks being fairly close to each other now. So there is a unified Alaskan rate, and no matter where you reside in Alaska, no matter how expensive or inexpensive, you get the same rate. However, if you are a non-resident worker at the time of your injury working in Alaska, or if you move out after you get injured and you go to some place that has an arguably higher cost of living, my division is tasked by the current statute to do a cost of living analysis and allow you to receive a higher compensation rate than you could have anywhere in the state. We don't really think that that's appropriate to pay people who are non-resident injured workers more than we pay our own injured workers. So Section 32 would preclude that and cap the rate that can be paid to a non-resident at the same amount that would be paid to someone if they were residing in Alaska. There's a provision in Section 36 that talks about coordinating private disability and workers' compensation benefits so that the combined benefits do not exceed workers' take-home pay. If you have any specific questions about this proposal, I have someone sitting with me who's helped develop that. Assistant Attorney General Knudsen helped draft that, but it is essentially what it says, that there are, under limited circumstances, some employees who get a private disability payment, which is not being considered when we do our workers' compensation payout. And for some limited number of people, they do sometimes get more than they would have if they had been working. And it's kind of viewed as not such a good idea from a number of obvious and not so obvious reasons, but the whole tenet of workers' compensation is you get a significant portion, but not all, of your take-home pay so that you don't have a disincentive to returning to work, and so that's the motivation for this provision. We've also heard some concerns about potential fraud in our system by any number of people. It's not... people talk about fraud from a variety of perspectives, and some people envision it as someone making a claim that they don't deserve. Other people envision it as an employer that's lying about the classification of their workers so that they get a lower premium, provider that may or may not really be giving health care treatment that they're getting money for. And so there is a provision in Section 40 that talks about broadening and strengthening the anti-fraud provisions under the Workers' Compensation Act. It's quite extensive, and it goes to great detail to show that there isn't anybody who can derive a benefit or a payment in the name of workers' compensation and not be violating the fraud provisions, so that we do have a right to enforce that right in the Workers' Compensation Act. I was asked by someone whether or not we were going to immediately run out and hire a whole bunch of investigators, and the answer is no, not at this time. I have talked to Director Hall at the Division of Insurance, and she has a number of investigators on her staff, and we're going to try and coordinate with the limited resources that we have right now and her resources, and with now having a specific authority to go after fraudulent situations and see if that doesn't fix it. If it turns out that we feel that we're missing a lot of fraud because we don't have sufficient investigation staff, then I propose that I will probably be back in front of the committee trying to explain why it wasn't there. But we just got kind of concerned about the overall cost of the proposal, and we would like to try and make it work within the resources that we currently have, with closer coordination between my division and the insurance division. Most of the situations that can develop in the name of fraud, because they are being they're trying to take advantage of an insurance company, they also represent an insurance fraud that is investigatable by the Division of Insurance. Similarly, there are improvements in Section 41 to the criminal anti-fraud provisions under the Workers' Compensation Act. We have been asked over the years why we don't have a very long track record of successful prosecutions, and people have offered a variety of reasons, but a lot of times what it boils down to is that the standards, the higher standards that are applicable to criminal activity as they're viewed by the district attorneys who know what it is that they could address or not address, come down to that the criminal provisions in our act are inadequate. So in Section 41, we propose to change that language to meet some of the concerns that were expressed by the law enforcement community, so that if we feel that we do an investigation of someone, that they are likely to agree that this is something that can be prosecuted, as opposed to just being concerned that we've done good work, but we haven't given them the tools that they need to get a jury to convict someone.
Senator Seekins has a question.
Just on page 40, on the first part, on page 30, you're looking at the hearing. In that hearing, you'd have to find by a preponderance of evidence. If I just take a look at page 32, you're looking at if there's credible evidence. What standard of proof are we looking at?
I'm sorry, Senator, the second one?
Page 32, line 3. The director determines here that there's credible evidence of the benefit provided. In this section, the director should notify the affected employer insurance adjuster upon conclusion if the fraudulent act or misleading statement are perpetrated against the division. Are we saying here that this is just if there's that credible evidence is for notification?
Yes.
There's a higher standard of proof to be determined whether or not the act actually took place?
Through the chair, Senator. That's correct.
Okay. So I want to make sure.
There is one provision in the legislation that I'd like to highlight, and this is something that's been kind of a gray area for us, and so we'd like to have it addressed, and that's why it's in Section 38. As the committee members are probably aware, there are certain people that run a business that don't have to cover themselves, and they can opt to cover themselves if they wish to. Partners, for example, sole proprietors. We have seen in the last few years, since Alaska has changed its laws to have more limited liability companies, we have seen questions raised about where does a member of a limited liability company stand in relation to their legal obligations and whether they can or must get workers' compensation coverage. There's been a bit of a divide on that question, and there wasn't any clear guidance. So what the bill proposes to do in Section 38 is to confirm that a member of a limited liability company need not have workers' compensation coverage to start with. But if the limited liability company has an insurance policy for its employees, and if they wish to add the members, the company members, to the covered people under that insurance policy, they may certainly do so. So it gives the limited liability company a clear statement of where its members stand initially and gives them the clear option that they can insure those members if they so choose and properly inform an insurance company that binds their coverage. That is just something that, as I said, was something of a gray area, and it was kind of perplexing to people about what their liabilities and responsibilities were. And so that's what we would help help resolve that system. And finally, under this heading, we had recommendations from a variety of attorneys representing people in the workers' compensation system, again, looking at ways that we can speed up the system. And they wondered why we didn't have a release of medical records of some sort that would be signed with the initial injury report, because there are sometimes delays associated with just getting proof of medical treatment, and until you get that proof, then the insurer has no obligation or any knowledge that they even need to make a payment. So what this would do is require the division to redo our injury report so that there's a limited release for medical records that right from the get-go that applies to treatment for the injury that just happened. It's not a broad release, because we recognize that there are some people that due to confidentiality concerns are concerned about not signing a release for everything. That raises some other problems that we can discuss at a different point, but at least at this point we would have a requirement that from the beginning, bills and records for medical treatment that happened with the particular injury would be immediately available to the insurer and their adjuster. And if they weren't submitted by the injured worker, they could be obtained by the adjuster, and we'll get things flowing faster. We see that as we can understand why attorneys on both sides of the bar raised that, because it is something that could be an unnecessary delay, and we're not interested in doing that. We're really trying to focus on things that can speed things up, even if it's just incrementally, because they all add up as you go through this whole process. We would maintain in Section 27 the confidentiality of medical and rehabilitation records that are held by the division or the new appeals commission. And in Section 28, it would ban the division from assembling or providing individual records for commercial purposes. We've got a number of folks that ask us to give them information. We are getting more and more information into our system that we request, because we're trying to get it electronically filed. And now we're getting this intersection where people recognize that there's more and more information about employers, employees, anybody you can think of, and they come back to us and they ask us to stratify this data and give them some kind of report that they can use for a commercial purpose. So we want to still be able to give information to people that need it so that they can get their health care, so that they can get paid for providing that health care, so that an insurance company or an employer or an employee can get information they need to settle or resolve or if necessary, have a hearing on a disputed claim. But we're trying to restrict the scope of information that we give out for purely commercial purposes. Okay. This is another section I'd like to address, is improving return to work benefits while reducing the cost of doing that. Section 35, we're proposing to gradually phase out the second injury fund. The second injury fund is perceived as archaic in the modern employment system by many observers. Last time I looked, there were 17 states that had revoked their second injury funds in the last, since in the 90s and the 2000 era. The way that the second injury fund is filled is through a 6% contribution rate currently based on all time loss benefits that are paid by an insurer, so it's an additional 6% on top of what they pay in benefits. To try and get more bang for that buck and reduce the cost, what we would propose to do right now is phase it out incrementally. the people that have already established, the insurance companies that already have a right to get the reimbursement under that fund would continue to get those amounts reimbursed, but they would not be able to make new claims going forward. As the old claims were gradually paid off, the contribution rate would ramp down. There is in our statute a ramp that says if the balance in the fund is a certain amount, it's 6%. If it goes up, it's 5%. We would hope that it would go down to 5%, then 4%, down to zero. And then eventually when the Commissioner of Labor officially notified the Lieutenant Governor that all of the obligations were defeased, then the fund would be no longer in existence. We are interested in reducing delays in determining reemployment benefits eligibility, which is something that I mentioned just a bit ago. And Section 14 is specifically allows injured workers and their employers or insurers to stipulate to the injured workers eligibility for reemployment benefits. That will simplify the determination of eligibility for those benefits, and we think it will have a significant monetary effect on the overall cost of the system, although it's difficult to quantify. I'll just kind of give you a snapshot of what we did in 2003. There were just over 1,000 requests for eligibility evaluations that were filed with the division in 2003. As of the end of January of 2005, about 50% of those requests had been finally ruled upon. That's, you know, by my math, on average, if it was in the middle of 2003 and it went to January, it would be about 18 months. So some would have been a shorter period, some would have been a little longer, but we're taking a long time to get eligibility evaluations done in the first place. On average, it's 160 days. So our hope is that if some proportion of these become stipulations, then that will be 160 days on average times each one of them, and that will save the need to pay 041k benefits, which is a time loss benefit that's paid while people are waiting for that evaluation to be concluded. Now, the next section is Section 16, and it talks about redefining the trigger for when you're eligible for reemployment benefits. And part of that process right now is to establish that you have physical capacities that are less than the physical demands of certain jobs. And a big part of the delay that we're seeing is trying to get someone, typically a doctor, to opine as to whether somebody's going to have physical capacities going forward that are going to have be diminished to the point where they can't meet these requirements of certain jobs. And there's an awful lot of people that don't request the benefit within the anticipated 90-day period because they haven't even been had the opportunity to get a doctor to opine about whether they already really need it. And that adds a lot of delays because, among other things, then after they finally find out that they think they may have triggered their entitlement, then they have to ask to be excused for not asking on time. So the trigger has been redefined in terms of how long somebody is off work. If they're off work for 45 days, then it triggers a requirement for our reemployment benefits administrator to give these people information about their potential entitlement to reemployment benefits. That's a direct response to complaints that we hear that people don't have adequate knowledge of what their entitlements are. After 60 days, then either the injured worker or the insurer could ask for an evaluation of their entitlement. And then after 90 days off work, our reemployment benefits administrator would be required to just send it out for an evaluation. Nothing further said. We were just trying to get something that's just an easily defined trigger. And I can understand that some folks would prefer that we continue to use this the current system. And my response to their concerns is that it is just slowing things down so much that it's really inconsistent with our our goal is getting people all their benefits, but particularly their reemployment benefits, vocational rehabilitation, quickly. The 1988 Act was predicated on the understanding that of all the benefits, that retraining benefits were most critical to get going quickly, because studies had shown that that particular type of benefit was unlikely to yield a good result unless they got going quickly. So you see in Section 041 of our current Act all these short time frames, for 14 days to ask, for, you know, 90 days to ask, 14 days to make an assignment, 30 days to get the evaluation completed, and yet I'm talking about 160 days to get the average report back. So what we're trying to do is make this system a system that is understandable, that people understand when their rights are triggered, and they can ask for the right if they want it, which is a big point. The legislature has gone out of its collective way to listen and respond to people who said that reemployment benefits, vocational rehabilitation, should be elective, that the employee is a voluntary system, that an employee or injured worker doesn't have to do retraining benefits unless he or she wants to do it.
On that point, Janie, did you get that? We received a query from a Robert Sullivan. I've given you the letter, and get an opportunity to respond to that if you would give me a response, please. There are some concerns on this issue.
Yes, I know Mr. Sullivan, Mr. Chairman. That he provides services under the Workers' Compensation Act, I'd be glad to do that.
Thank you.
What we have seen happen, and you've heard other people talk about this as well, right now there's a certain way of determining entitlement to these reemployment benefits that I just discussed. Currently, you can choose to take that benefit and embark on it. You know, it's typically some type of training, retraining, and for a period of years, oftentimes, you're entitled to get some cash benefits to tide you over while you're doing the retraining. There are many people that choose not to take that retraining, but based on the possibility that they could be found qualified for it, or they have been found qualified, and they could actually go through it if they wanted to, even though they don't want to. They all enter into a settlement that can be a considerable amount of money. What we're trying to do in Section 16 is to have people still have their right to this benefit, but to try and save some money by saying, all right, now you have been found eligible for this benefit. It is a voluntary benefit. You have two choices, but the choices are slightly different. The first choice continues to be take advantage of these benefits, and we hope and we'll do everything we can to help you. The second choice is if you are not willing or do not want for any reason to take these benefits, it may be that you are qualified for the benefit, but you have other things to do. Maybe you're going to retire. Maybe there's a job that doesn't rule you out from this benefit, but you're intending to go back to. There's any number of things. You can no longer hold out the possibility of getting that benefit as a reason to get a large settlement. You either take the benefits or you elect to take a smaller cash payment, which is being described as a job dislocation benefit, which can be used for any purpose. And that is tied to the impairment rating that you get for your personal injury to your person. And that ranges from $5,000 to $13,500. There will be no strings attached to that, so the injured worker can use it for whatever they want to do. But within 15 days of having been found eligible, they will either be getting into the program and using the benefits that we will still extend to them, and they will be not diminished in any way, or they will take this lesser amount, which is much less than what the typical settlement is if, you know, people settle rather than do their training. We think that that's a fair way of moving the system along and reducing costs without cutting the actual benefit. The benefit will be unchanged if you choose to take advantage of it. Now, I just want to touch very briefly on there are several provisions in the beginning of the Act that have to do with changing the way that insurance is done for workers' compensation in the state. Director Hall has already testified about it some. If you have any specific questions, there are people here from the Division of Insurance that could address them. But the point that I would like to make is that it's a further improvement. Last session, we were here trying to bail out the Guarantee Association, as you'll recall, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and we were successful in doing that. But there are people in the industry that said that we would have been even better off if there were bonds in place to collateralize some of the liabilities of the insurance company so that if one of them went out of business, these bonds could be picked up and the cash represented by those securities could be sent by the Division of Insurance to the Guarantee Fund to actually pay some of the benefits rather than shifting all the costs to the companies that didn't go under. So there's a specific provision which I like from my perspective because it's one more way of getting some additional funds to the Guarantee Association to pay the benefits to the injured workers on behalf of the employers that legitimately insure themselves but have the misfortune of the insurance company go under. And so I certainly support that. I am not at all an expert in insurance, and I cannot tell you the fine points about how that operates. But if we do have experts available, if the committee have any questions. That leaves two sections that have had some degree of commentary. The first that I'd like to address is increasing the speed, efficiency, and predictability in workers' compensation appeals. And the way that would be done is to replace an appeal to the Superior Court with an appeal to an appeals commission, which is within the Department of Labor. This provision is designed to bypass the Superior Court for a number of reasons and is not an add-on to the additional system. It would actually take the first level of appeal, which right now is the Superior Court, and replace it with the Appeals Commission. It would maintain the next step of appeal, which is guaranteed to everyone as an Alaskan citizen, which is to have recourse to the Alaska Supreme Court, and it's always the Alaska Supreme Court that tells all of us whether we've done the right thing or the wrong thing. The motivation behind this is Commissioner O'Clary touched on, and I won't belabor it, is that the Superior Court is made up of numerous individual judges. They're not necessarily experienced in any particular matter of the law, including workers' compensation. And their decisions do not establish binding legal precedent. So the Appeals Commission would be offered to have a single situs where you would go to have your appeals heard by folks who have experience in workers' compensation. It would establish legal precedent that could be overturned by the Supreme Court, but otherwise would be in place and could be relied upon by people who are in a similar situation in other claims. Right now, there is no way of establishing a definitive legal interpretation short of going to the Supreme Court, and it takes a good number of years. So this is a way of getting the Workers' Compensation Board, which will continue to be made up of numerous panels doing hearings, so that is not being changed, unlike some of the suggestions last session. But you will be able to go to the Appeals Commission and ask them on the executive branch side to give you a final definitive statement of what the Workers' Compensation Board really thinks about the workers' compensation law may mean, for example. And other people can rely on that in doing their business and paying benefits or knowing what they're entitled to receive. And that will remain in place during those years where there is not a Supreme Court decision. And if someone does go to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court confirms it, then fine. If they overturn it, then that's fine too. But you know, at least in the interim, everybody was operating under the same rule for a period of years that they can't do right now. It would also, in Section 31, it would allow me, the division director, to file an appeal with the commission. If there was an unsettled question of law, and if a party was not represented by legal counsel. So this is also another way to try and address the concerns we have about the difficulty of someone who's unrepresented making a legal case. The court system is well aware of that. I'm sure any administrative decision maker is also aware that it's very, very difficult for the average person to make a legal case. This would give the director an opportunity to try and wade in if there was an unsettled question of law, because we simply don't have the resources to do that in every instance. The appeals process would be somewhat speeded up in that the commission would be required to issue its decision within 90 days of record closure. which is, well, I guess on average we'd probably think it would take perhaps 6 months to complete this kind of process as opposed to maybe 8 months to 18 months in the Superior Court system. Then there were two specific concerns that you heard testimony about last session, and I'm sure some of those people still have those same concerns, and so they've been specifically addressed. First is that board-level determination, hearing panels would continue as they are now. They would continue to take testimony, and their determinations about the credibility of a witness that testified to them, their testimony credibility, would be binding on the commission. And that's to reflect that there are people that are concerned that you can't really judge credibility of somebody's testimony unless you look them in the eye, and also concerns about possible constitutional issues that could be raised based on certain Alaska Supreme Court decisions that find people have a right, if there's credibility involved, to have an in-person hearing. The second is by constructing the commission out of one person with legal background and then lay board members or lay commission members who are volunteers who are paid a sum for each day that they participate. That is to address concerns as kind of, again, two concerns. One is the expense. You heard concerns about if there were three attorneys or some odd number of attorneys that the expense would really ramp up. So this is an attempt to address those concerns, and also that there was a concern that if appeals were heard solely by people who were lawyers, that we'd lose some degree of the human element or empathy or something that is over my head since I'm an attorney. But so that's also to address those concerns.
Senator Seekins had a question.
In the four members, two for employees, two for attorneys, is there anything to preclude, I mean, for employers and employees, anything in the statute that would preclude that those public members from being attorneys?
Through the chair, not that I know of, no. I would suspect from the amount of money that they wouldn't be paid that they would probably have to be retired attorneys.
And I could see that some employees may continue to pay their employees. Some person being a member of the administration of a labor union may be paid to be there by the union at the same time. So it wouldn't necessarily mean that $200 a day is their entire compensation, because I wouldn't anticipate that they'd be that busy to be paid that as a salary.
Basically, if it's listed as an attorney and lay, it seems like
doesn't say as lay, though.
This might be a good spot to take a couple-minute break, and we'll stand at ease for just a couple of minutes, and then we'll continue. We have 45 minutes, and Senator Seekins will be back here in just a moment. Mr. Lozanki, you have other information you want to share at this point?
I have a few more minutes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. I do have a couple of people that have a time constraint that are off net, and as soon as you're finished, we'll go to them.
Okay. What I would like to do is offer a clarification. I think I made a misstatement in regard to Section 36, coordination of benefits. It's pointed out to me by the drafter that I said private disability insurance would be weighed against workers' compensation benefits, and it's actually disability benefits that are received through the PERS system,
mm-hmm.
or from another employer funded disability system that does not take an offset on its own. So the disability that's paid by an employer, if they take the offset, then there is no double offset, so the employee gets the net.
Okay.
But
sure.
I said private, and it's not correct.
When he was going through that, I flagged that as an area for bringing his assistant or advisor to come and explain that in more detail at a later time, if we could just do that at the appropriate time.
Certainly.
I did want to flag that.
That didn't fall.
I'm led to believe that so far that's my first major strike against me, so I'll try to keep from striking out.
Maintain your record.
The last section that I'd like to address, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is maintaining medical benefits while reducing costs. As you heard from Commissioner O'Clary, one of the elements of that is to have a rollback of the allowable maximum amounts under the board's medical fee schedule to a fee schedule that was approved initially December 15, 1999 and applied to bills that were rendered in year 2000. Those rates would remain in place while the committee that the commissioner discussed the other day would be making its study of the workers' compensation health care delivery system and way that bills and costs would be reimbursed, which would have to be completed no later than March 1, 2007. It would continue protection for injured workers that exists in the statute now and would not be taken away, which is specifically injured workers may not be required to pay any fee or charge for health care services that are provided under the Workers' Compensation Act. And that is a question that I've heard from some people already. If there's a difference between what's billed and what's payable, will the employee be required to pay? And the answer is they are not allowed to be made to pay now, and that will be continued. There were some questions expressed the other day about this section.
The question in this arena, you know, it's like Medicare. If I want to be treated under Medicare, I could not pay the doctor more, even if I chose to. They can't accept it. Is that the same case here, that if there was there's a cap and I had the means that I could pay above that cap to pay the doctor's normal rate, would I be allowed to do that?
That's a good question, Mr. Chairman. I believe the actual verbiage is may not be required.
Yeah.
To pay.
If you'd get back to us on that. Thank you.
There's a proposal in Section 24 to have the board apply the Occupational Medicine Practice Guidelines of the American College of Occupational and Environmental Medicine to determine reasonable and necessary medical care under the Act. The ACOM, for short, is the nonprofit organization that has put these guidelines together, and they have a mission statement that I know we don't have enough time to get into all the specifics, but they propose that the purpose of the guidelines are to optimize the likelihood that injured workers are able to return to health and function as rapidly and safely as possible. That is their mission statement there. Those guidelines would be presumed to be reasonable treatment, but you could depart from those guidelines based upon a preponderance of the scientific evidence.
Senator Deacon.
Could you describe to me how a person then would rebut by a preponderance of scientific evidence? How would that be done?
I guess it would typically be done either informally or formally with someone proposing studies or someone making the point that the individual situation that's encountered by that injured worker falls outside the expected range of the guidelines.
And how would that rebuttal be mounted? Would it be mounted by the injured worker's attorney or by the injured worker or by him retaining expert medical opinion to rebut the guidelines that are provided? Or I just envision it. I'm not trying to down to it. I'm just trying to figure
through
out.
The chair, Senator Seekins. I think it would be like the other types of potential disputes that the Workers' Compensation Board sometimes hears now, and therefore it could be something that would begin informally and might end informally with a practitioner or their representative talking to the insurance company and talking through what the situation is. But it could, under certain circumstances, end up all the way in a hearing with lawyers and advocates putting on additional information based on scientific studies things. I think it could be the full range. Some of them would be easy, and I imagine some of them would not.
And later on, if I can, Mr. Chairman, at the last sentence of that section says, well, you know, we could be looking at standards based on other scientific evidence-based medical treatment guidelines generally recognized by the national medical community, adopted by the board by regulation. Are there other generally recognized medical community guidelines other than this one from the American College of Occupational and Environmental?
Senator Seekins, through the chair, I believe there are a couple. I know there is at least one that I have a copy of in my office that I was sent. So there is at least one fairly comprehensive one, and I believe, based on what I've heard from the drafter of the ACOM guidelines, that there is, I think, at least one other one. And then I heard from Mr. Jordan in his testimony, he said that there were a variety of guidelines that have been published by a number of the specialty fields, and I'm not as aware of those, Senator.
Thank you.
There is a provision in Section 24 that tries to take advantage of any savings that would be available through the utilization of generic drugs in place of name brands by requiring that generics be used unless a name brand is medically necessary. Also, Section 24 tries to take advantage of any potential cost reductions by requiring the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to adopt a preferred drug list, something like that which was recently developed by the Department of Health and Social Services. The Department of Labor and Workforce Development would also be called upon to set procedures for establishing the need to depart from that formulary list. And then a final provision that I'd like to address today is under Section 25. And we propose to remove roadblocks to potential cost savings by allowing employers to develop preferred provider lists and to negotiate fee rates with preferred providers. Currently, there are statutory prohibitions against interference with anything that can be described as interference with the choice of physician. So this would be a specific authorization for an employer or an insurer to try to develop a preferred provider list and try to negotiate lower rates. However, the injured worker would not be required or restricted exclusively to the use of people on that list. So the employer and insurer could try to develop such a list, and they could give it to the injured worker, but they would also have to tell the injured worker and specifically inform them that they do not have to utilize a doctor or any health care provider on the preferred list, and that they can continue to choose a provider who is not on that list, which, you know, may or may not make it easy to get a preferred provider list done up if you can't guarantee that anybody will use it.
Kind of a lightweight list if it's voluntary.
So I thank the committee very much for their attention, and if there are questions that I can try and address, I'd be glad to. If not, I will certainly pursue them and give you answers in writing.
Senator Seekin has a question.
Yes, Mr. Sankey. Looking at page 20 on the draft, in looking at the paragraph 1 on line 3, we're specifying a schedule there from a published bulletin dated December 15th, 1999. Just for information purposes, do you have any idea of what the difference between that schedule is and what that schedule would be today in terms of percentage difference?
Senator Seekins, through the chair, I believe that we have a chart that was included in your packets, and I may not be able to lay my hands on it right away, but the point I'd like to make is there were certain services under the codes that were analyzed for what percentage difference between the 2000 rate, or the rate that was effective December 15, 99, and the highest allowable currently under the fee schedule from December of 04. I'm sure that the senator appreciates, but I just want to make clear that the way the board sets those rates is to have a company do a statistical analysis of all the bills that are rendered for a certain procedure. So all it does is say the highest that could be paid in full as of 99 would be a certain amount. And that presupposes, based on statistics, that 9 or 8 out of 10 providers charge less because it's defined in terms of the 90th percentile. So when you look at if there is a change for 2004, and presuming that it's higher, it's still possible that someone that was charging less than the highest amount in the beginning of 2000 may or may not be above that now. But the simple answer to your simple question is that each one of those codes potentially could be a different percentage, mm-hmm. simply because it's based on bills.
For a number of reasons.
Yeah. I had Jane forward a question about the codes and trying to get some more information, and if you could, when you get that, I'll share it with the committee, and it would be interesting to note, too, in dollar amounts compared to other states, what this cap creates. If it's limited to December 99 rates in Alaska, how does that compare with Washington state rates today, or something like that? Get some comparison there.
We can certainly try and help you out with that.
Questions for Mr. Lozanki? Thank you for all your time, being thorough and patient with us. I would like to check these two people who had a time constraint in Kodiak, and I'll go to them, and then we'll come back here to Juneau for some additional testimony. Norm Wooten in Kodiak, are you with us, sir?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Norm Wooten. I'm Executive Director of the Kodiak Chamber of Commerce, and I'll keep this very brief, but workman's comp is an issue that, according to my members, it's close to putting many of them out of business. The rates continue to rise, and I'm not sure how much longer they can afford to do it. Just an anecdotal comment, we run a litter patrol here in Kodiak through the auspices of the Chamber of Commerce. We hire four teenagers, and I have an adult supervisor, and next year my workman's comp bill is going to be $2,100 for that 3 months to keep those four teenagers working. And so anything that you can do to alleviate that and to provide some relief to employers, particularly small businessmen, will be muchly appreciated and good for the economy of Kodiak as well as the rest of Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wooten. And Mike Martin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Martin, president of Brecken Enterprises, construction company here in Kodiak since 1954. We have currently about 95 employees. I'm signatory to the operators, laborers, teamsters, and carpenters unions. From 2004 to 2005, we've had an increase of $277,000, or a 63% increase from 2004, just on a workman's comp. How it works in the construction business, we have approximately $20 million worth, or close to $20 million worth of work for work this year that didn't take in consideration that type of increase, so I have no way to recoup from or to bid that type of increase into the work. Secondly, an issue in workman's comp, we had an employee, actually one of my favorite employees, 40 years old, had a heart attack on the job. Had nothing to do with work-related. He showed up in the morning about 15 minutes later, not because of any exercise, had a heart attack, had everything to do with the fact that it was a heavy smoker, overweight, yet that cost me $250,000 through insurance, which was a part of the increase. And I guess the last quick issue that I want to talk about is a frivolous actions and injuries that take place. It is very prevalent, unfortunately, with some of the new people coming into this industry. They know they're going to be laid off. The next thing you know, they have a back injury. Very difficult to prove contrary to that. and there are many things that are taking place in this industry right now, along with the fact that we only have one carrier, which is Alaska National, and no other opportunity to have anybody else to carry this type of insurance. So there is, you're having, I've been listening to your discussion now for the last hour and a half, and you're talking about the employees, and I'm very glad the fact that you are interested in helping those folks out. But I can tell you right now, if you don't do some help for the employers, those employees aren't going to have jobs from companies like us that have been around a long time. They're going to be companies that are billion-dollar companies that are self-insured and that can afford this type of afford their own self-insurance. And the small business people like ourselves and companies are no longer going to be around here if you folks don't figure out some way to help us out with these burdens that we're facing here currently. Thank you for your time.
And thank you. I'd like to come back here to Juneau now and Wayne Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wayne Stevens. I'm the president of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. I'd like to read briefly to you our position statement on workers' compensation and then offer a couple of observations. Certain workers' compensation structures and current escalating rates are an ever-increasing burden on Alaska's businesses. The State Chamber strongly urges the legislature and administration to provide the environment for stable, fair, and competitive marketplace for both the insurer and the insured. The State Chamber encourages the legislature to diligently work towards a solution to the workers' compensation insurance crisis and make meaningful insurance and regulatory reform during the first session of the 24th legislature. State Chamber's workers' compensation premium in 2003 for four employees was $1,554. For this year, it's $2,774. An increase of roughly 78%, and that's with no claims history. We support efforts to make substantive reform to workers' compensation. We recognize that there is no single answer to solve the problem. We encourage all parties involved to make concessions to make this work. That includes the medical profession, the legal profession, the insurance industry, workers, and businesses. We need to provide an adequate safety net for workers hurt while on the job. But as Mr. Martin pointed out, let's not put the healthy worker out of work when the businesses they're employed by can no longer afford the premiums for workers' compensation insurance. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Doug?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Wolliver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. As you know, the court's decades-old practice is not to take a position on legislation. We don't take a position on the merits of this one either. In fact, having listened to this now for the second year, I'm glad we don't have to. It seems like a nearly impossible problem to solve. My only purpose in testifying is to discuss that one section of the bill, which I believe is in Section 31, that would bypass the Superior Court and send appeals from the agency directly to the Supreme Court. For the past several years, I think my testimony last year was we averaged 36 cases a year to the Superior Court, taking into account 2004 numbers, it's now 34 cases a year. 75% of those cases don't go on to the Supreme Court. We average now an average of about 8.3 cases a year actually get appealed to the Supreme Court. The court doesn't believe that the passage of this bill is going to dramatically change the number of cases that come to the court system, and there are a variety of reasons for that. One, we already only receive a fairly small percentage of the decisions and orders issued by the Workers' Comp Board. We don't think that small percentage is likely to drop. One, because there are, out of all of the workers' comp claims that are filed every year, out of the tens of thousands, there are always going to be some that even after the thorough process of review, there are going to be cases that are close calls where either side can disagree, where reasonable minds might disagree, where one side or the other is going to want to appeal the agency decision. If we have appeals from our very best Superior Court judges, we'll have appeals from even a very competent Workers' Comp Commission. Second reason is every year or so there are at least a couple of novel legal issues. Those will always go to the court system for final resolution. Additionally, there are some people who simply don't trust the administrative agency process, and we see this in all different types of administrative agencies and all different types of of cases. In order to get to the court, you have to exhaust your administrative remedies. In this case, it would be through appeal through the commission, but those folks want their day in court. And they will. The only way to get your day in court is to appeal to the court system. And finally, there's always a handful of people every year that are simply tenacious litigants who are going to keep fighting until they win, even if their claim isn't particularly reasonable. So we expect roughly the same number of cases as we have always seen. The only difference will be that they'll come to the Supreme Court directly as opposed to coming to the Superior Court first. As I mentioned, right now, the Superior Court takes off about 75% of those cases. One of the stated goals of many provisions in this bill, including this one, is to help streamline the process and to get a final resolution of these cases as quickly as possible. One of the court's concerns about this particular provision is that it will be working against that goal. We've heard testimony, and I've done some checking, too, on our own statistics, that most of the Superior Court cases take somewhere between 8 and 18 months to resolve. Our total, taking into account all of our administrative appeals which come to the Superior Court, we get about 300 a year. I would like to say only about 34 are workers' comp, but we get a lot of administrative appeals a year, and they average about 9 months to be resolved by the Superior Court. I just went back through the cases that went to the Supreme Court last year, the workers' comp appeals that went to the Supreme Court in 2004. They took an average of 20 months to be resolved. So what you're going to be doing in many of these cases is moving from a forum that takes 8 to 18 months, but generally less than a year, to a forum that takes 20 months. You'll save time on some of those cases. Any case that would have been appealed to the Supreme Court anyway, that 25% of the cases, you'll save time on by simply cutting out the middle step, which is the Court of Appeals, the Superior Court. But you will add time to the vast majority of those cases. So I'm not sure that we're meeting that particular aspect of the goal of the bill, which is to speed things up. So that's the basis for our fiscal note. Our fiscal note is an attempt to add staff to the Supreme Court that can specifically focus on these cases and these cases only as a way to not only offset the amount of time typical cases take in the Supreme Court, but also to make sure that these cases don't have a significant impact on the amount of time it takes for the court to resolve all of the other cases that it has before it each year. And there are several reasons why the Supreme Court takes longer, very legitimate reasons. The Superior Court judge is a committee of one. You could probably move bills pretty quickly, Mr. Chairman, if you were the only one that had to decide them. But the Supreme Court's a deliberative body. There are five members. It takes longer by design. And so the point of the fiscal note is to try to reduce that amount of time to meet the goal of the bill, which is to move these cases as quickly as possible, although I don't know the Supreme Court's ever going to move as fast as the Superior Court. We could at least work in that direction. So anyway, that's my testimony. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Yeah, Doug, one of the problems is that the Superior Court isn't precedent-setting. Is there any way without setting the entire American system of jurisprudence on its head to make that precedent setting, would that solve that? Is there some way you could solve that problem?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that. I don't think that you could, and I'm not sure that you would want to. One of the concerns that the sponsors have is that there's a whole variety of different judges involved in these cases. You could have one. Generally, a precedent-setting body is a single group of judges, and there's consistency of the same group is sitting with the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. It's hard to have 34 different independent judges each setting precedent, which may conflict with each other. Additionally, with respect to the precedent setting, if the commission is setting precedent, the problem of a lack of Court of Appeals setting precedent is probably significantly less than it is now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Woolover, without speaking for the courts, do you think we're approaching a time when we need a civil court of appeals?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Seekins, through the chair, we are. In fact, it probably won't be too many years before the Supreme Court is asking for an intermediate civil court of appeals, although I can tell you the impetus for that is not likely to be the small number of workers' comp cases. It would be the family law cases that are currently an ever-increasing percentage of the Supreme Court's caseload.
Mr. Chairman, in my overview of the courts and through the Judiciary Committee, it appears that that is fast approaching in the analysis that I've gotten from the court systems and from individual members of the court, that we may be very close to the point where we need to establish a civil court of appeals, which could be a precedent-setting court on matters like this.
In many states that where their workers' comp does bypass their trial court, it's because they have an intermediate court of appeals that or civil appeals that does set precedent.
Excuse me. Thank you.
If I could ask one more question.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Wolliver?
If I'm not mistaken, criminal appeals court is 3 members?
To the chair, yes, it is.
So by adding 3 members to the court on a civil court of appeals, that would handle a broader spectrum of cases. If you had to say that compared to members that were paid full-time as hearing officers in the system now, any idea where that would flesh out in terms of expense?
Through the chair, in a word, no.
I was going to take a shot at it. Thank you.
And are you looking for a job? Okay, thank you. I'd like to go off net now to Dr. Don Duddy, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don? My name is John Duddy, Dr. Duddy. I'm an orthopedic surgeon from Anchorage. As the president of Alaska Physicians and Surgeons and a member of the Board of Counselors for the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, I implore you not to support Senate Bill 130. As an orthopedic surgeon and a business owner, I understand that the workers' comp system is in need of repair, but the current bill before you is not the solution. This current bill has taken the sledgehammer when a surgical scalpel was needed. As you may already be aware, the physician community participated in the ad hoc committee appointed by the governor. We agreed with their recommendations. As you previously heard on Tuesday, those recommendations have been totally disregarded. The bill in its current form will throw the baby out with the bathwater. The 3 components to this bill have already been previously discussed. The first component, which would be new to the workers' comp system, is the generic drug list. I suspect the adoption of a Medicaid-like generic drug list would be supported by the medical community. The next 2 aspects of Senate Bill 130, a rollback to the fee schedules of December 1999 and implementation of practice guidelines, I fear may have serious ramifications for the access of care for Alaska injured workers. Excuse me. The physician community, in conjunction with the ad hoc committee, requested a list of procedural codes in November 2004 to help the committee's identification of overused services. We were never able to obtain this data. This data would have helped identify potential abuses in the systems and would have been able to be helped curb specific excesses. Since the ad hoc committee's recommendations were never brought forth, specific recommendations couldn't be made. Instead, the governor's office has recommended implementing broad-based guidelines utilizing the American College of Occupational and Environmental Medicine practice guidelines. My colleagues in orthopedic surgery across the nation tell me that these guidelines simply don't work. They don't take into account patient comorbidities such as their overall state of health or other factors. When these cookie-cutter approaches to medicine are implemented, such as in California, they hurt the injured worker. In summary, I'm very concerned that the end result of this bill, if passed, will result in diminished access of care for the injured Alaskan worker. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. I think it's very clear we understand the opposition to the limit on payment and the guidelines, yet part of our challenge is dealing with the escalating medical costs, and I'm interested in those codes as well. But other than that, would you have, or your organization have other suggestions about how we might deal with these escalating medical costs?
Has anyone considered a price freeze?
I'm sorry?
Has anyone considered just a price freeze?
A price freeze at current levels?
Yes.
I think it's been discussed among some committee members, yes.
I mean, that would be the simplest approach. I mean, the bigger issue is not the change in fee schedules. I mean, that's an issue for a lot of physicians. But the biggest concern are the guidelines. The guidelines is going to make it so difficult to practice medicine. I mean, they don't take into consideration, and I've read the American College of Occupational Health guidelines. They just don't take into account every aspect that I see as an orthopedic surgeon. I mean, the perfect example of it is a colleague of mine in California had a patient with an ankle fracture. This guy weighed 400 pounds. The guidelines say they specify the amount of time necessary or expected for recovery, and they specify the weight-bearing status. In other words, the patient can't be weight-bearing. And it says that you can only have crutches. So when this injured worker applied for a wheelchair, it was turned down. The 400-pound guy couldn't use crutches, and he ended up falling and breaking his wrist. I mean, they don't. Cookie-cutter approaches to medicine don't work.
Okay. Well, thank you. We appreciate the additional information.
Okay. Thank you.
Now go back to Kodiak now. Lorraine Stewart?
I'm sorry, Lorraine had to leave, but Elena is here.
Okay, we're sorry we missed Lorraine, but Elena, if you'd like to speak.
Miss Lorraine, but Elaine Larson's still here waiting to speak.
Okay.
I've been in business here in Kodiak for 25 years. I have a construction company. I build apartment buildings for my own personal use, and I keep them for my own personal inventory. I'm not like Mike Brecken that, you know, builds for profit and has a much bigger business than me. But on a smaller scale, I'm here to tell you that workman's comp is such an issue for me every year when I go for my insurance renewals. If I'm not doing a big enough payroll, I can't get insurance. If I'm not doing $200,000 worth of payroll, which is small in comparison to what Brecken's got to pay, and I'm not near in the same boat, but it still affects me in the same sort of way, I can't even get workman's comp, and I get thrown into pool, which then I have to pay 33% premium for being a special assigned risk person. I've been in business 25 years, and every year when insurance time rolls around, it's just an absolute horror show. If I'm not doing a big enough payroll, again, I get thrown into pool, and every year I wonder if I'm even going to be insured with my liability and workman's comp. I've never had claims. My risk ratios are great. So I know you have. I've sat here for an hour and a half along with Mr. Martin, listening to your issues. But I'm here to tell you the fun has gone out of being in business. 25 years. I'm a pretty good member of the community, and we just did a project, $1,400,000, for the little town of Kodiak last year, which is a sizable project. But it gets every year, you get to wonder if it's your last year being in business with the workman's comp skyrocketing. So thank you for hearing me, Juno. Elaine Larson, Kodiak, Alaska.
Okay, well, and thank you, and trust me that we share your concerns that it's a problem and it'll have fallout for everyone if it's not solved. In Matt Sue, Joel Sigmund, please.
Yeah, that's me.
State your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
I'm Joel Sigmund. I'm an injured worker. I'd like to know who does workman's comp actually work for, because in my book it's not the injured worker. It's the insurance companies and the doctors and whoever else. I don't know. You guys tell me. But I've been living a nightmare. The insurance companies, I don't think there should be a workman's comp board. I think the insurance companies should have to cover their responsibilities. People shouldn't have to sell everything they worked for all their life to be able to get help and have to go on welfare because they cannot take and get anywhere. I mean, I've been struggling for 8 years now, and I've lost dang near everything I've owned. I had to get rid of it to get any help. I've been denied. I got dyslexia. That I asked them to take and read me the things in the workman's comp board, and they got all their attorneys there and everything. Well, they refuse to read them to me. They just tell me, well, either you sign it or you're cut off, and you lose all your benefits. And they would not read me anything. I asked them, well, who do I go to see to get help so you can guide me in the right direction? And, well, we can't give you no advice. I mean, what is the point of having a workman's comp board if they ain't there for the people that's been hurt? These businesses and the insurance companies are making a killing, and the injured worker is being, he's a dead man walking. He's no longer, you know, my life is no longer my life. Everybody else runs my life anymore. I can't do what I used to do. My family's done without. It's the workman's comp thing's a nightmare. And I've gone to attorneys, and when I tell them, well, who the insurance companies are, well, oh, no, we won't have nothing to do with that. We won't take it. So where do I go? I can't read and write. I don't know how to go about it. And I've really been discriminated against all the way through this. And, I mean, I'm kind of against this thing you guys got going here, because there's a lot of contradictions in there and stuff that ain't right to me. And it looks like what it's basically for is to protect the employer and the insurance company. And as far as the injured person that's totally handicapped for life, he ain't worth nothing. You know, my whole life's been shot down the drain. My family's gone through a nightmare. And there's a lot of other people out there. I mean, there's people out there, I've been denied, and so have they. There's people who's lost their houses. They've lost everything they've ever worked for. They've lost their families. And then they take their lives, you know, because they ain't got nothing else left. There's a whole bunch of stuff that needs to be figured out to where the worker gets compensated instead of feeling like, well, like a number, like you're in prison, because when you get hurt, you're no longer a person, you're a number as far as the workman's comp board goes. So I always thought of myself more as in a number. You know, I've had a lot of people that I've been a hard worker that would always hire me back, and now I can't go to work. So what am I supposed to do? And everything they got going, Social Security and welfare and all this, they're trying to cut that out. I get $17 a month for food for three people. Well, yeah, that's going to get me a long ways, ain't it? I mean, nobody knows what workman's comp is all about until they wind up getting hurt and losing everything they got, and see just how corrupt the system actually is. There's a whole lot more I got to say, but you probably ain't got all day to listen to it. But I really feel like I've been discriminated against, and my family's been having to suffer for the workman's comp and the insurance companies and the employer's mistakes. And I guess that's all I can say right now, because I know you guys are kind of on a time schedule, but I'm really disappointed with the system, the way it works.
Well, thank you, Mr. Sigmund, for sharing your experience with us. We're certainly trying to make it better for everyone, and you sharing your experience will help.
If the insurance companies would pay for what they're supposed to, everybody wouldn't have to go on welfare, which would save the state a lot more money, too. But, you know, and I don't see what, like I said, I'd like to know who the workman's comp board does work for.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Off net, we have Bill Pfeiffer, please.
Yeah, this is Dr. Bill Pfeiffer from Ketchikan. I'm the Alaska Chiropractic Society Vice President and the American Chiropractic Association Alaska Delegate for the state. SB 130 and the governor's transmittal letter indicate that the ACOEM guidelines are to be used as a benchmark for medical treatment. You should have in front of you two studies that I forwarded to Senator Bundy's office. They're both analyses of those ACOM guidelines that conclude and advise against using these guidelines without any substantial change. The mandated use of these guidelines are not based on solid scientific investigation nor a consensus of those likely to be affected by its implementation. They point out that these guidelines do not currently represent an unbiased and comprehensive means of evaluating care rendered to injured workers and should be substantially modified or rejected. So given that I've got 1 minute, that kind of concludes that, and I'd ask you to review those documents and the Alaska Chiropractic Society and the American Chiropractic Association stand ready to help you in any way that we can. I also have testimony that we submitted to the ad hoc committee that I'd be glad to make available to your committee or any of the other senators or representatives also.
Yeah, if you forward that to the committee, I'll see the committee members get a copy of it.
Okay, thanks.
All right, and thank you. Continuing off-net, Michael Cunningham.
Michael R. Cunningham, I'm the Chief Financial Officer at Chugach Electric Association in Anchorage. We have two primary workers' comp classifications, clerical and electric light or power company, and in both of these classifications over the last 3 years, we've seen rate increases between 78 and 86% in computing our manual rate. So obviously we've had to do with our workers' comp coverage, such as increasing our self-insured retention, things of that nature to make the premiums more palatable. At this point, we're still evaluating the bill, and we do thank you for the opportunity to enter this testimony. Thank you.
You're certainly welcome. Well, that brings us to our allotted time, and apologies to anyone who didn't get a chance to testify. This bill is still a work in progress, obviously. We're still just getting started in markup. We will address the bill again next Tuesday at 1:30, and and that will be the sole focus of our attention at this point. So, but thanks to all that testified, both here in Juneau and on the internet. And at 3:30, we'll stand adjourned.